KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Before our very eyes, unelected shadow government is conducting a hostile takeover of the federal government.
Elon Musk is the world's richest man. He does not hold public office. How did he come to play such a big role in the U.S. government?
For Tuesday, February 4th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. At One North Carolina Church, a progressive pastor spent years promoting racial justice.
Within weeks of November's election, he was out of a job.
A lot of these people left the church a few years ago. If any of you talked to them, you heard the same thing over and over again. I'm tired of being indicted because I'm white.
Also, a look at President Trump's plans for the Department of Education.
And cultural critic Ira Madison III's new memoir is part coming-of-age story, part cultural analysis.
Music, TV, at the mall every weekend, watching sometimes multiple movies in a day. That's sort of where my pop culture knowledge all comes from.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Democratic lawmakers are decrying Elon Musk, the billionaire and close advisor to President Trump, whose government efficiency team DOGE is culling federal agencies, including shutting down USAID. But Republicans hold majorities in the Senate and the House and have not pushed back much on Musk so far. NPR's Elena Moore reports on how Democrats are using their limited power to drive opposition.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats are sounding the alarm.
Whatever DOGE is doing, it's not democracy. We know what democracy's like. It's out in the open. It's not secret.
Democratic senators like Chris Murphy are speaking out.
I worry that the American public is not going to rise up against the seizure of power if they see Democrats collaborating with Republicans on the floor of the Senate on a regular basis to pass legislation or support nominees.
Murphy says if Democrats can raise public sentiment, it could move some Republican lawmakers to oppose Trump-backed nominees or legislation. But that has yet to happen. Elena Moore, NPR News.
This week, President Trump began exploring dramatic cuts to the Department of Education, an agency he's repeatedly threatened to shut down. NPR's Shirnaki Mehta reports.
What is taught in America's classrooms is already up to states. Federal law has said so since 1965, and the restrictions on the federal government to determine what can be taught in schools have only become firmer. The Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA, was enacted near the end of Obama's second term. It clearly forbids the federal government from playing any role in determining state or local curricula. And Trump isn't the first president to suggest closing the Department of Education. Republicans have been calling for it to be shut down basically since it was established in 1979. Now, if that suggestion comes in the form of an executive action, the decision would lie in Congress's hands. Shirnaki Mehta, NPR News.
Google has dropped a commitment not to use its artificial intelligence systems for surveillance or weapons. As NPR's Bobby Allen explains, the tech giant says its new policies are aimed at protecting people and supporting national security.
Back in 2018, when it was revealed that AI developed by Google was being used by the U.S. military's drone program, the backlash was swift. Both Google employees and outside groups put pressure on the company to end the relationship. And it did, with guidelines stating it would no longer work with the government on drone projects. Now, Google has reversed its decision. In an update to its ethics guidelines, Google removed a ban on using company AI for weapons, surveillance, or any other uses that could cause harm. In a blog post about the move, Google executives wrote that the company will respect international law and human rights, but that there's global demand to use its technology to support national security. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Stocks closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow is up 134 points. You're listening to NPR. The State Department has begun the process of withdrawing all USAID personnel stationed overseas by this weekend. The plan to recall overseas staff was described to NPR by current and former government officials not authorized to speak publicly who feared retribution. Seth Green, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, wrote in an email to staff today saying, quote, "I understand the feasibility concerns as well as the emotional toll this will take on those impacted." State Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The order is the latest move by the Trump administration to dismantle USAID. Syria's interim president traveled to neighboring Turkey as part of an expanding quest for assistance to rebuild his war-ravaged country. NPR's Greg Myrie reports the new Syrian leader has been reaching out to countries across the region.
A day after visiting Saudi Arabia, Syria's interim president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, stopped in Turkey. Syria needs assistance on multiple fronts, and Turkey is well positioned to help. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, said his country could provide security assistance and economic support, though he didn't give details. Turkish construction companies could play a key role in the massive rebuilding campaign needed for Syrian cities and towns. Some 3 million Syrian war refugees are still in Turkey, which wants them to return home. Sharaa led the rebels that ousted Syria's dictator in December, and Erdogan said, quote, a new page has been opened in the region. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Damascus.
Crude oil futures prices closed lower, oil down 46 cents a barrel to $72.70 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. We begin this hour with upheaval at the U.S. Department of Education. The White House has confirmed to NPR the broad outlines of a plan to use executive action to shrink and potentially dismantle it. The news comes as dozens of department employees have already been put on paid administrative leave. NPR's Corey Turner has been following the story and joins us now. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so I want to start with these workers who have been just put on leave. Like, what do we know about them, and why have they been told to stop working immediately?
Well, we know that over the course of the last week, some department workers began receiving a pretty vague email. We're talking at least 74 non-management workers so far. That's according to a union that represents federal employees at the department. And this email, Elsa, it says, quote, you will be placed on administrative leave with full pay and benefits pursuant to the president's executive order on DEIA, end quote. And it says that this is not being done for any disciplinary purpose. And I have heard from both the Education Department and the White House in the last 24 hours, and they confirmed that these moves are about rooting out DEI programs in the Education Department.
Okay. Well, I know that you've had a chance to talk with some of these workers who have been put on leave. What are they telling you?
Well, they're telling me a very different story. They say none of them actually works on DEI programs. Instead, they work on education policy in sub-offices all across the department. The one thing, Elsa, they all seem to have in common is that they attended, at some point, a short diversity workshop the department has offered for years, even going back to the first Trump administration. In fact, I have an email sent in June 2020 by a Trump political appointee congratulating employees for being chosen to serve on a department diversity committee. And I know that several employees who served on that Trump-era committee are now on paid administrative leave.
Interesting. Okay, well, what about this executive action to make even bigger cuts at the Education Department, potentially? Like, what can you tell us about these possible plans?
Earlier today, the White House confirmed the outlines of a kind of two-pronged strategy. The action will instruct the Education Secretary to start by essentially cutting the low-hanging fruit. And by that, I mean programs at the department that were not created by Congress, and that means they're not protected in statute. The challenge here is the department's big ticket responsibilities were all very clearly created by Congress and would essentially require a vote of Congress to cut them or even to move them outside of the Education Department.
And what kinds of programs fit that description?
Yeah, so these are the signature programs, Elsa, including administering Title I, which sends billions of dollars to big city and small town schools that serve lots of low-income families. Mm. It's administering IDEA, that's the federal civil rights law that protects the rights of students with disabilities. And it's managing the $1.6 trillion federal student loan portfolio. Now, again, I have not seen this executive action. It hasn't been issued yet, but the White House acknowledged that changing or moving these things would require Congress, and that this action will call on the education secretary to draft a plan for Congress to do just that. The question then will be, are lawmakers going to go along with it?
Exactly. Okay, well, when should we be expecting this potential executive action?
Well, my sources now tell me the White House is likely to wait to issue this action until after Linda McMahon has her Senate confirmation hearing. She is Trump's nominee to become the next education secretary, and that hearing has not yet been scheduled.
That is NPR's Corey Turner. Thank you so much, Corey.
You're welcome, Elsa.
In Washington these days, Elon Musk seems to be everywhere. In the 15 days that Donald Trump has been back in the White House, Musk and his Department of Government Efficiency have been moving to change every corner of the federal government. The billionaire entrepreneur and his team have gained access to a sensitive government payment system in the Treasury Department. They're pushing to drastically reduce the number of federal employees. So how did the world's richest man come to have such a big role in the federal government? And why does he want it? To help us answer those questions and more, I am joined by Zoe Schiffer of Wired. She's the author of Extremely Hardcore Inside Elon Musk's Twitter. Zoe Schiffer, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
To that basic question of why does Elon Musk want this? This is a man with plenty to keep him busy. He owns Tesla. He owns X. He owns SpaceX. What's the allure of adding the federal government to his portfolio?
You know, I always reflect on this quote from Sam Altman, who's the head of OpenAI and previously a friend of Elon Musk, now possibly an enemy. And he has said, Elon Musk desperately wants to save the world, but only if he can be the one to save it. And I think that that is really true. Elon Musk is very worried with global humanity extinction level problems, and he casts himself in a leading role in trying to solve them. At the same time, he has some practical concerns with what was going on in the United States. And he said very openly that if Vice President Kamala Harris had been elected president, that she was going to crush Tesla. And he felt like his businesses were at stake, the future of the companies, the empire that he had built.
Hmm. So how does he square his politics with this role? Because at one point he was a moderate Democrat, and now he is Donald Trump's arguably strongest ally.
Yeah, the moderate Democrat piece started to really shift. I mean, it happened over the course of many years, but there were a couple of key moments. The COVID-19 pandemic was one of them. He was very against the lockdowns. He thought that basically the Democrats' reaction to the pandemic was quite overblown and was detrimental to businesses. He felt like the Biden administration had shortchanged him in giving him the credit that he felt he deserved for electric vehicles. And, you know, he's been going through a process that I think we can say a process of radicalization on the internet, becoming more right-wing, more anti kind of woke. And this was a core reason that he got involved with Twitter. He said that the company was overrun with something that he deemed the woke mind virus. And I think it's fair to say that when he looked at the country prior to Trump getting reelected, he felt like the country was kind of teetering on the brink of getting overrun with the woke mind virus once again, and he needed to step in and save it.
Hmm. To the question of his status, the White House says Musk is a, quote, special government employee. Trump himself, Monday in the Oval Office, was praising Musk's abilities, but said, look, we have to approve what he does. The bottom line is no one elected him. He has not been confirmed by the Senate. Should he have this much power?
I mean, even before he took on this role, he arguably had more power than anyone who wasn't in control of a nuclear arsenal. This is a man who has massive wealth, and he also has a lot of political power. He has contracts with governments all over the globe through Starlink, and these countries, including the United States, are quite dependent on his work. So now he's in an interesting position where before the election, while he had so much power, there were also a number of investigations that were ongoing. The US government was actively looking into decisions that he had made while running his companies. And, you know, there was the possibility of fines or regulations. Now he is in the position of, in some ways, regulating the regulators, and his power looks pretty unchecked.
That moves me to ask, what does Musk stand to gain personally from his work with Doge?
I think that to the extent that Elon Musk can continue to amass wealth and power, he will continue to do so. He now is in the position of being able to influence what companies get government contracts. He really has the ability to like overrun how government has historically worked in this country and change it. And while some of what's happening, you know, looks unusual, and I think that there are legal questions, like they will take a while to resolve. And in the meantime, Elon and his team are really running rampant.
You said there's a few areas that are worth actively looking at. Can you give me an example of places where you see potential questions?
Well, I mean, you know, there were a lot of investigations into Tesla and its self-driving technology prior to Trump getting reelected. I'm curious to see where those lead. Like, I think that there are big questions about how, you know, his companies will change and benefit from his new position that we all need to be aware of.
So where does this go? How does this end for him and for the citizens of the United States?
I will be curious to see. Right now, it looks like we are watching Elon's team kind of infiltrate one agency after another. I think that we have yet to see like what will come of all of this. At the same time, I want to make sure that we are all paying attention to what the larger goal is, because just like when Elon took over Twitter and he had kind of all of the goals that he talked about publicly. He wanted to rid the platform of bots and spam. He wanted to eliminate child sexual exploitation material. These were all things that most people could agree on. At the same time, a few years after the acquisition took place, we're in a position of saying, well, those goals do not look like they were achieved in many cases. And the overall goal, the kind of unspoken initiative to turn Twitter into X, into a political operation that would elevate right-wing politicians in the United States and around the globe, that goal has been very successful. And so I think we need to ask the question of what is Elon Musk's larger goal with the federal government of the United States?
Zoe Schiffer, she is the Director of Business and Industry at Wired. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. A progressive pastor at a North Carolina church spent years promoting racial justice, and he has repeatedly called out President Donald Trump. Within weeks of the November election, the pastor was out. Publicly, church leaders say his removal had nothing to do with politics or his preaching, but some congregants feel betrayed, and they say the conflict inside their church reflects a broader one within the American left. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Charlotte.
Pastor Ben Boswell says he was determined for Myers Park Baptist Church to confront its whiteness. As he explained during an online anti-racism seminar he hosted several years ago.
We have a wedding policy that has been described by our current chair of deacons as WASPy. Our space as a church, very colonialist in style, and it needs some decolonization. We're going to be in a constant process of doing what I call a whiteness audit.
Boswell says he ran into resistance from congregants who, for instance, told him to take down Black Lives Matter signs. Boswell persisted.
I like to joke, churches have sacred cows. Sacred cows make the best hamburgers.
Myers Park is a white liberal church in a neighborhood where mansions can sell for more than $4 million. After the November election, Boswell gave a sermon in which he likened this moment to what he called, quote, the gathering dark of Hitler's rule. He referenced Christ's resurrection and urged congregants to maintain hope.
Where do we go from here? We go back to the beginning. We do what our ancestors have done. We get up and we walk toward the tomb because the fight's not over. It's just beginning. Amen.
Provocative sermons were nothing new for Boswell, who'd been at the church for 9 years. But a few weeks later, the church's board of deacons, its governing body, met on Zoom. They voted 17-3 to ask Boswell to step down. NPR obtained the audio. It provides a rare window into the thinking of an organization when the tone of its social or political messaging clashes with its business model. Marcy McClanahan was head of the board. In the meeting, the first reason she cited for Boswell to leave was plunging attendance.
We have gone from approximately 350 members attending on average each week at service in 2016 when Ben arrived, to approximately 150 members attending on average each week in 2024.
Fellow Deacon Robert Doolin was more direct.
We got to put more butts in the seats.
In an email to NPR, Doolin said he personally loved what he calls Boswell's powerful prophetic preaching. The problem, he says, is that it had worn thin with others. Here's how Doolin put it in the meeting.
A lot of these people left the church a few years ago, in the last few years. If any of you talked to them, you heard the same thing over and over again. I'm tired of being indicted because I'm white. I'm tired of being banged over the head every week about immigrants and LGBTQ. And I just want to come to church and be encouraged.
As people left, their contributions left with them. Since 2020, the church's budget has shrunk by nearly a quarter.
Ben needs to leave in order for our church to take a different direction and grow, because we are dying on the vine.
Good morning. We are glad that you are here with us.
Myers Park Baptist is a cavernous red brick church with a big white steeple, and it wears its progressive politics really right on the front of the church. You've got a giant sign here that says 80 years of inclusivity, community, spirituality, and justice. And on the other side, open to all, now and forevermore. In the meeting, Deacon Alan Davis warned that getting rid of Boswell would undermine that very message.
It will be very difficult for us to continue to sell the narrative that we are this inclusive, open to all, one welcoming, growing community, when what will come out is that we've snatched the keys from the 10-year minister who had been pushing us to confront whiteness, to challenge racial justice in our community.
Davis was among three deacons who resigned in protest. In an interview, McClanahan, the then board chair, called Boswell, quote, a fantastic and visionary preacher, and she insisted the church would continue to advance racial and social justice. But some of Boswell's supporters say the conflict at Myers Park is part of a much larger one.
This is just a continuation of the issues we saw throughout the disagreements in the Democratic Party writ large.
Nicholas Ryan has attended Myers Park since preschool. He's now 30.
There's a group of us who are younger and more passionate and maybe a tad more progressive who are fed up with just being told to wait, don't worry.
After services in December, the church leadership met with the congregation behind closed doors to discuss Boswell's departure. Afterwards, many parishioners were eager to talk.
My name is Bruce Griffin. I'm a warehouse worker in Charlotte.
Griffin wore a San Francisco 49ers jacket. He said Boswell created a wonderful open community here. Now he's bitter.
I feel the church betrayed me. I feel the congregation betrayed me. Just today at this meeting, some of the same people that I feel betrayed me came in and it was straight to business. And there was no hugging. There was no fellowship.
I mentioned that some white congregants felt beaten down by Boswell's continued emphasis on social and racial justice.
As a black man, our response said that I feel beaten down every day.
Are you going to stay here at the church?
I will not.
While Griffin was talking about leaving Myers Park, Elizabeth Peterson was returning for the first time in years.
Reverend Boswell has divided the church rather than unifying the church.
Peterson says that for a long time, Myers Park seemed more focused on people of color and LGBTQ folks.
I wished that he could have brought his energy for diversity and for change of the culture of the church and included us to come with him.
And when you say us, who's us?
People of my age. I'm over 65, definitely not wealthy.
But do you think you'll come back to the church now?
I think I might, yes. I think I will.
Pastor Ben Boswell has heard these sorts of things before.
When you've been the dominant culture for so long, focus and attention on anyone who's been marginalized feels like a slight against you.
He says the conflict at Myers Park is part of a much bigger national trend to roll back things like diversity, equity, and inclusion programs.
We just happen to be in a moment now in American history where that work is coming with a cost and people are getting tired and backing away from it.
But church leaders say their concerns extended to Boswell's management. Others say he focused too much on social justice and not enough on tending the flock, one of the church's strategic goals. Bob Thomason is a former chairman of the Board of Deacons. He said he was speaking as a longtime church member.
Most of us, all of us, are very supportive of social justice, but for some people, being able to focus on social justice, it would be a welcome luxury because they have alcoholic spouses, they have children that are addicted, they have cancer, they have these personal needs, and that gets to the other part of the strategic plan, which was caring for the internal community.
Pastoral part of the
pastoral
job.
Pastoral part. Not so great there. We were basically taking care of ourselves as best we could.
Boswell says he was committed to pastoral care and devoted a staff or two at full time. Boswell knows that some people think he made a mistake by focusing so much on racial and social justice, but he says he'd do it again and will continue to preach that message whatever he does next. Frank Langford, NPR News, Charlotte.
This is NPR News.
It's been a tough few months for Iran.
The economy's in shambles. Their resistance axis has crumbled. There's historically high anti-regime sentiment.
Why some anti-government activists in Iran have found new hope against the hardline regime. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. For people who use marijuana, it can be tough to find safe, well-regulated cannabis products.
When you move from prohibition to legalization, you know, it takes time to significantly reduce the size of the illegal market.
The latest installment of our new series, How Safe Is Your Weed? After the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. On Capitol Hill, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. appears to be on track to become the next U.S. Health Secretary after winning support along party lines, but Oregon Senator Ron Wyden joined other Democrats in the Senate who oppose Kennedy today.
Do senators want their legacy to include disregarding basic health science and instead elevate conspiracy theorists? Making Robert Kennedy Secretary of Health and Human Services, in my view, colleagues, would be a grave threat to the health of the American people.
Louisiana Senator and Dr. Bill Cassidy had previously expressed concerns about RFK Jr.'s nomination, but reversed course this afternoon, saying Kennedy assured him that he would not topple the nation's childhood vaccination program. Kennedy's now on track to be confirmed, absent any last-minute vote changes. Nassau County, New York, says it will cross-designate 10 of its police detectives as immigration enforcement officers. NPR's Martin Costi tells us it's the first significant expansion of local police cooperation with ICE agents since President Trump started his second term.
Many jurisdictions already work with ICE to identify potential deportees inside jails. But New York State's bail reform law has made it harder to hold people long enough for ICE to come and get them. And that's why Nassau County Police Commissioner Patrick Ryder wants to streamline the process.
If we make an arrest and I'm going to let somebody out on an appearance ticket because of no bail at my station house, I will be notifying ICE that this person is here undocumented and that they will be able to come and pick that individual up.
10 Nassau police detectives will have the authority to make immigration arrests, though the county executive says they won't be, quote, out looking for illegal migrants in the absence of other criminal charges. Martin Costi, NPR News.
This is NPR. The commissioner of the National Football League says the organization remains committed to its diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, even as companies nationwide are rolling back DEI programs after criticism from President Trump. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
Speaking to reporters in New Orleans on Monday ahead of the upcoming Super Bowl, Commissioner Roger Goodell said not only is the NFL sticking with DEI, but also that diversity makes the league better.
We're not in this because it's a trend to get in or a trend to get out of it. Our efforts are fundamental in trying to attract the best possible talent.
In his first term, President Trump clashed with the league over its handling of players who took a knee during the national anthem as a way to protest racism and police brutality. Back then, Trump urged fans to boycott the NFL. Now the president is planning to attend the biggest game of the year, the Sunday Super Bowl. He'll be the first sitting president to do so. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, New Orleans.
Those soaring egg prices are piquing the interest of more folks in backyard chicken coops, a trend that grew during the pandemic. The federal government says more than 13 million hens have been lost or slaughtered since December following a bird flu outbreak that's caused the price of a dozen eggs to double. Today, the Waffle House announced a 50-cent surcharge on all egg items at its more than 2,000 locations due to the high cost of eggs. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher today. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Ira Madison III's new memoir practically explodes with pop culture references, from the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers to Lil' Kim. You got it going on. When we talked about his memoir, it's called Pure Innocent Fun, and we'll get back to that title later. He told me as one of the very few black kids at his high school, he retreated into pop culture.
Music, TV, at the mall every weekend, watching sometimes multiple movies in a day. That's sort of where my pop culture knowledge all comes from.
At the top of Madison's list is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show from 1997.
It's my first day. I was afraid that I was going to be behind in all my classes, that I wouldn't make any friends, that I would have last month's hair. I didn't think there'd be vampires on campus.
For young queer kids, he explains, it was more than just a story about a ditzy blonde teenager hunting vampires.
Well, I think the main thing about Buffy is that she is this unassuming girl. I think that Joss Whedon first described it as, you know, you see a blonde girl walking down a dark alley in any other horror movie, you think that she's about to die. Mm-hmm. And in Buffy, she can take care of herself. What I really love about the show, too, is, you know, through her friends, Xander and Willow, and then later Cordelia and Oz, and, you know, her watcher, Giles, you have this group of people who sort of band together, and they have a secret amongst themselves. You know, they have, like, a secret club they're a part of. And no matter what other people think about them who, you know, might perceive them in some way in school, they're saving the world every night, you know? And I think that maybe for queer people watching that show sort of gave you a sense of worth, you know? It taught you that you are not necessarily what people see you as.
I want to stay with this for a minute because as a gay man growing up, you had to come to terms with your own desires and secret, how there weren't a lot of active role models for you to see of men being comfortable, being out there loving other men, though you do talk about an uncle that has since passed. It just sounds to me like that is an experience that's relatable for so many people, even today.
Yes, I mentioned in the book at one point a coworker at Borders Bookstore in Chicago, who was an out gay man who like loved Mariah Carey. He was a lamb and introduced me to loving Mariah Carey more than I already did. I think that that was one of those first people that just made me feel comfortable in my own skin, made me feel like I could speak the way I wanted to speak. I didn't have to code switch. I didn't have to watch my mannerisms around him. And I think that that was incredibly helpful to me as a college student in Chicago. And I didn't experience that until freshman year of college, you know?
It's not until that point when you're in college that you start really coming out to close friends, as you describe in the book. And something that stuck with me is you said that even though you were coming out and taking this big step and starting to open up to some of your friends, that it still felt like a cliff. It still felt like the end of your world. Can you tell us why?
I think that once you are coming out to people who you are close to, there's this thing that I feel like people, particularly my millennial age group, thought that college is where everything sort of changes. You know, like if you just get to college and you can come out freshman year, you can be who you want to be. But when you do that, it's usually with your friends. It's usually with other people you might know on campus. And then you have to figure out when you're telling your family, you're figuring out when you're telling the world, you're figuring out what it's going to feel like when people look at you and can tell that you're gay.
I want to talk a little bit about voice, because I know that many people who are hearing our conversation likely know you for your work on the podcast, Keep It, that pop culture podcast that you host. And Because of that, I found it really interesting hearing you reflect on your relationship with your own voice. I know that you wrote about when you were younger, thinking that your voice was a high-pitched gay voice, and like what it signaled to people about you when people heard you speak. You also talked about how sometimes your voice read as white, which is certainly something that I've had people say to me. Can you just talk a little bit more about that and what it felt like all of those years ago?
I mean, speaking voices give you a lot of hangups, don't they?
Indeed.
I feel like I have whiplash, you know, with my actual voice. You know, there's the period where I thought I sounded too white. There's the period where I thought when I answered the phone, you know, people would say miss, thinking I was my mom. And I reflect on that in the book, wondering if it was because I was code switching into the cheerful white voice that my mom would use on the phone when you're talking to bill collectors or something. And then later, I sort of hated my voice when I tried to sing, you know, in theater things at school. Then doing the podcast, I remember specifically, I could not listen to it for maybe the first year of it at all.
Interesting.
I hated the sound of my voice. And I've gotten used to it now, but even then, I don't think people's voices sound to them what they sound like to other people. I was shocked whenever people would tell me that, you know, I sort of had like a deep voice, you know, like a Luther Vandross thing going on, so to speak. Because to me, it did not sound like that at all.
It sounds like you've made peace with it, though. Maybe you and I can both commiserate over the fact that if you're in this industry long enough, that means you must, in fact, listen to your recorded voice back to you.
You do, often, but thank God for people who transcribe interviews.
You know, when we have these conversations, we often start by asking an author about the title of their book, but I wanted to end with this because it is derived from a quote by one of the queens of reality TV. I am a huge Real Housewives of Atlanta fan. Yes, your book is pure innocent fun. Tell us where you got the title from.
So the title comes from the first season of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, where NeNe she's making fun of Kim Zolciak's singing, as she often did on that series. And then Kim gets mad at her. They have this fight. And during a confessional, NeNe is shocked that Kim would be upset with her. And she says, it's just unfortunate that people could change something that was just pure innocent fun into drama.
Pure innocent fun into drama.
One, that was a meme that I share all the time with my friends. And so it's a phrase that has always stuck with me. But when I was thinking about a title for the book, I was just thinking about the fact that, sure, nostalgia, it seems like pure innocent fun. You're looking back on your childhood, you're remembering things fondly. And then once you dig a little bit deeper, you see your anxieties, you see your fears, you see the traumas there. And I think that that reflects the process that everyone has of remembering anything from their past.
Ira, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Ira Madison III. His new collection of essays is Pure Innocent Fun.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In the hours after a Black Hawk helicopter fatally collided with an American Airlines jet last week, social media erupted with the claim that the craft was piloted by a transgender service member named Joe Ellis. But it wasn't true. Ellis is a member of the Virginia National Guard, and she took to Facebook to show that she was still alive.
It is insulting to the families to try to tie this to some sort of political agenda. They don't deserve that. I don't deserve this.
Extremism experts say it's part of a familiar political playbook. NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef joins us now. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so I know that you have closely watched how both popular and political narratives against transgender people have shifted over the last several years. How does all of this fit the patterns that you've been seeing?
Well, Elsa, in recent years, it seems like after every high-profile tragedy, there's almost always a social media firestorm claiming that the perpetrator was transgender. You know, we saw it after school shootings in Uvalde, Texas, Appalachia, Georgia, Madison, Wisconsin, and Perry, Iowa, just to name a few. Now, there was one school shooting in 2023 where the perpetrator was indeed a former student who was transgender. Frankly, given how many school shootings we see in the country, Elsa, that was an outlier. But it did further feed a picture that some on the right have been trying to paint about trans people as terrorists or mentally unwell. You know, in fact, GLAAD, an LGBTQ advocacy group, has found trans people to be four times more likely the victims of crimes than the perpetrators. And I think it's worth noting in all this that as the Trump administration has focused energy and time in these early weeks on things like trans military service, trans youth access to medical care, trans legal recognition on documents like passports, trans people make up less than 1% of the U.S. population.
Right. But how does the administration's policy relate to the disinformation spread online by some social media accounts?
I spoke about this also with Elizabeth Yates. She's with the Western States Center, which is a nonprofit that works to support inclusive democracy.
Some people are spreading this narrative because it's lucrative to pump up their followers on social media and increase engagement and increase revenue, right? Like grifters that way. But that is simultaneously increasing the power and visibility of bigoted and authoritarian actors who are promoting this for a specific political agenda.
So we saw state-level legislators lead anti-trans efforts even a decade ago to restrict trans access to bathrooms and sports teams, and that helped push the issue into the mainstream. And now it seems anti-trans measures are politically rewarding. But frankly, it's not a new political strategy.
Yeah, say more about that. What's the history behind this strategy?
To answer that, I spoke to Hanna Steverson of Human Rights First, which is focused on human rights.
One of the first trans health clinics in the world was in pre-World War II Germany. It was the Institute for Sexual Research in Berlin, and it was one of the very first targets of the rising Nazi party.
And so the concern here, Elsa, is that when it becomes okay to dehumanize one marginalized group or minority group, that can easily turn against another population.
That is NPR's Odette Youssef. Thank you, Odette.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. For people who choose to use marijuana, it can be tricky finding safe, well-regulated cannabis products. One problem for consumers? A lot of marijuana is still being grown illegally, often by criminal gangs that ignore health and safety rules. For our new series, How Safe Is Your Weed?, NPR's Brian Mann found it can be nearly impossible for buyers to tell the difference.
On a bright morning in Fairfield, California, officers with the State Department of Cannabis Control bang on the door of what looks like all the other suburban houses on this street. They break open the door, and Sergeant Aaron McAtee heads inside. The home's been gutted, transformed into a smelly mess of marijuana plants, grow lights, chemicals, and pesticides.
But you can see the mold that's down on the tarp down there. Yep, that's mold.
A dozen years after states first started legalizing recreational marijuana, this is the complicated world of American cannabis. Weed is as normal to many consumers as a glass of wine or a bottle of beer, and a growing number of companies offer state-tested, regulated products. But a huge amount of the cannabis being sold in the U.S. still comes from bootleg operations like this one. As McAtee drives on to the next illegal grow house they plan to raid today, he says it's often hard for his own officers to tell legit weed from the criminal stuff.
Our undercovers will buy cannabis from people who are outwardly pretending to be legit. I mean, they're going to tell you that they have a license. They're going to tell you that everything they're doing is legit.
Advocates of cannabis legalization hoped the legal weed industry would quickly drive out black market competitors. Instead, criminal marijuana gangs are thriving. Paul Armentano, head of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, says many consumers still find themselves buying illegal weed products where sourcing and safety are uncertain.
We're talking about a market that lacks transparency and accountability. Whether I was getting cannabis or alcohol or my broccoli from an entirely unregulated market, I'd be concerned about any number of issues.
Often that black market weed winds up on store shelves, packaged in ways that can make it indistinguishable from legal, highly regulated cannabis. It turns out the U.S. has gone through this kind of muddled transition before.
The decisive vote of the 36th state against prohibition is happy news for the great...
Alcohol prohibition was repealed in 1933, but many states kept liquor bans on the books into the 1950s, creating the same kind of patchwork we now see with marijuana laws. Liquor bootleggers and alcohol smugglers continued to thrive for years.
When you move from prohibition to legalization, you know, it takes time to significantly reduce the size of the illegal market.
Bo Kilmer is an expert on marijuana markets at the Rand Corporation. He thinks one problem is that marijuana is still illegal under federal law, so there aren't standard consumer safety regulations. He also thinks states focus too much on regulating legal weed companies without helping them compete with criminal organizations.
After they pass legalization, they'll spend a couple of years figuring out what the regulations are going to be and issuing licenses, but there hasn't been a lot of focus on what they're going to do about the illegal market.
One of the biggest advantages for criminal gangs is they ignore federal laws that prevent legal weed from being shipped across state lines. In Fairfield, California, a government truck backs up to another illegal grow house, preparing to haul away a big crop of seized black market weed. Sergeant McAtee says this cannabis might have wound up on store shelves anywhere in the U.S.
A lot of the places that we hit in California, they're shipping their cannabis out of state. You'll make tenfold what you'll make in California.
Cannabis experts interviewed by NPR say consumers do have a much better chance of avoiding illegal marijuana contaminated with mold, pesticides, and other chemicals when buying from a regulated retail store. But it's still important to ask questions about sourcing and potency and examine packaging carefully. The hope is over time, high-quality, regulated products will win out, offering cannabis buyers more choice and quality and more protection. Brian Mann, NPR News.
We
With Valentine's Day on the horizon, you might be thinking of putting together a playlist or even a mixtape for that special someone in your life. Well, our friends at NPR Music are here to help. They put together a list of lesser-known love songs to spice up your soundtrack. Here's All Songs Considered host Robin Hilton.
There are probably more songs on the planet about love than anything else. And chances are, you've heard the big ones a million times. Etta James singing At Last or Peter Gabriel's In Your Eyes. But sometimes, big things come in little packages. Like this incredibly sweet song called Engine Love from the singer Mira. Engine Love is all about the ways that someone can make your heart go thumpity-thump, kind of like a motor that's skipping a beat. That feeling of butterflies when you're absolutely smitten. Of course, love can feel way more complicated and intense than that. Poets and scholars have even said falling in love can feel like dying. And if that's your jam, check out singer Linda Diaz and her song, Watching Ourselves Die. Maybe it's the idea that to truly love someone, you have to let your ego die, to be vulnerable, and to give yourself over completely. Whatever it is, this song from Linda Diaz absolutely makes me swoon. But love doesn't have to be so crushing. In fact, it can be the thing that saves you. And for that, try Daniel Lanois' wondrously beautiful song called simply, I Love You. Think I'll call you up and say, please, baby, please. I love you. This song, featuring Emmylou Harris, doesn't mince words, but it's ultimately about struggle, about the desperate burdens and baggage we carry, and all the ways that love can make it better.
That's Robin Hilton, host of All Songs Considered. For a complete list of lesser-known love songs, go to npr.org/allsongs. And rip at the fool's head, follow your scent and linger.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare.
Each day I'll do a golden deed by helping those who are in need. My life on earth is but a span, and so I'll do the best I can. Last evening sun is sinking low, a few more days then I must go to meet the deed that I have done, where there will be no setting sun. The only life that will endure is one that's kind and good and cure, and so for God I'll take my stand.